Welcome back to the program. Back in the early 80s, it's estimated that there were over 50 companies that controlled or influenced media here in the U.S. Today, that number is less than six, and in spite of the dramatic increase in blogs, the web, 24/7 cable, there clearly is a homogenization in our media. More than how this happened, which we've talked about a great deal here on this program, what impact has it had on our democracy, and most importantly, on the proliferation of new ideas, on debate, and on the intellectual creative destruction that is the very essence of a free society? Joining us today to talk about this is a man who has spent over 40 years on the barricades of what we read and what we talk about. He is Andre Schifrin, and he was for 30 years the publisher of Pantheon Books. In 1999, he left Pantheon and founded the New Press. He is the author of the previous book, The Business of Books, and Dr. Seuss and Company Go to War. It is my pleasure to welcome Andre Schifrin here to the program today to talk about his latest work, Words and Money. Andre Schifrin, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you here. We were led to believe for a long time that the proliferation of blogs and the web and the internet and so many other outlets in television and cable would in fact increase our opportunities for information. And in fact, the opposite has more or less turned out to be the case.
Right. No, I'm afraid your analysis is correct. And the problem is that people are confusing form and content. It's the people who do the journalism, who do the actual writing, who look into the political issues that need investigation are getting to be fewer and fewer, just as the number of outlets is getting to be larger and larger. So in 2008, just for example, over 16,000 working journalists in America lost their jobs. And last year, it was 10,000 just for the first half of the year. So as the crisis grows, as the newspapers don't make the money that was expected of them, the number of people who are actually writing the news has diminished dramatically.
And, of course, corresponding to that is that the costs of gathering news have gone up exponentially as well and don't fit into the corporate model of journalism today.
Well, one of the problems, of course, is with that model. For many years, Wall Street figured that newspapers should make 26% a year, which is an enormous amount. And when the Knight Ridder chain had the misfortune the other year of making a mere 19.6, they were sold off. And a lot of the papers in that chain, including some of the best of the out-of-town papers, just were closed down in that process. So the problem, in part, is that the conglomerates in general, the media conglomerates, have these very, very high profit expectations, and when suddenly they're no longer met, no matter how unrealistic they were, then people are out of work.
Of course, in part, as you've talked about with respect to the publishing industry and the business of books, and as we see in so many other areas, a lot of these expectations come out of the need to pay down debt as a result of all of this consolidation.
Right, that's an important part of it. But it's also the fact that, for the most part, the media conglomerates are based on television, newspapers, magazines, Condé Nast, that kind of thing, whose income comes from advertising, or whose income used to come from advertising. And so they felt that the book publishing companies that had only made 3 or 4% over the whole of the 20th century were poor cousins who shouldn't be supported, who shouldn't be subsidized, as they put it, by their other holdings. So they tried to increase the profit in book publishing from the 3 or 4% to 15 or 20%. And, of course, that was impossible to do without totally changing the nature of what was being published.
And, of course, in this consolidation, we are seeing companies that are multifaceted in terms of being involved in the publishing business, the magazine business, the television business, et cetera, et cetera. Talk about the impact that that's having.
Well, you know, the changes have been overwhelming, really, and the major problem that's happened with the press is that the advertising has gone to the Internet. It's fallen from magazines, but for newspapers, much more dramatically. So the source of income has gone down, and with that, the financial crisis that we've just been describing, the fewer people who work in the papers, the less news, the fewer readers, and you have a downward spiral. At this point, the latest figures show that 83% of young people think there won't be any newspapers around in 10 years from now.
And is it true, though, that for young people, though, and you talk to a lot of them, you find that they are getting their news, they're just getting it in entirely different ways. They're not picking up the paper. They don't have the habits that we all had growing up, but a lot of them are getting it from sources online.
Right, but those sources are the ones that are depending on the newspapers for their information. There's a very small amount of the news that is generated by people who have their own blogs or their own local news-gathering organizations. For the most part, if you look on Google every day, the stuff they have when you turn on the machine is entirely taken from newspapers. And, of course, Google doesn't pay a nickel for any of that. And one of the things I suggest in the new book, in Words and Money, is that maybe there should be a tax on Google to help support the newspapers because, you know, they haven't paid anything at all for all the stuff they're getting.
Talk a little bit about whether these issues that we're discussing really impact national and international news as well as local news and how they affect each differently in some respects. I mean, certainly the New York Times, the Washington Post are still doing their job, and we are getting a broader spectrum of national and international news there, but it's having a greater impact on the local level.
Well, on the local level, of course, most of the papers have closed down their offices in the state capital. They're no longer covering local issues of that kind, and those, of course, have traditionally been the areas where the degree of corruption has been the highest, and where people have needed the Fourth Estate, the traditional role of investigative reporters. But I want to disagree with you a little bit on even the Times and the Washington Post. I think one of the most striking things that happened in the last few years is the way in which the press simply did not cover the lies that led to the war in Iraq. As you may remember, just as we went into Afghanistan, even before we went into Iraq, Condoleezza Rice got all the heads of all the networks into her office and said, "I don't want to see any more wounded civilians on your screens," remembering, of course, the effect that that had had during the Vietnamese War. So those, and that you still don't see them on the screen, by the way. So the networks downplayed the lies that Bush was peddling, and the New York Times and the Washington Post went along with it. There were some papers that were asking the right questions, but for the most part, the mainstream press did not. And I'm persuaded that if they had done their job correctly, we wouldn't have had this disastrous war at all, because it was clear from the beginning the CIA was leaking all over the place. There were endless sources that people could have gone to say what's really going on here, and we would have discovered very quickly that there weren't any WMDs or any of the other things that that Bush was claiming as his excuse. So there the main papers have let us down. They've tried to make up for it since. But at a crucial time in American history, they did not do their job.
Is there any reason to think, though, that in a different media landscape, perhaps one 30, 40, 50 years ago, that the results would have been any different with respect to an issue like that?
Well, there are two factors. One of them is that, you know, the traditional press has usually backed the government in times of war. They did so. They followed the government line in the Second World War and the Cold War and so on. You did not have a lot of independent journalists going to see what was going on in Korea, for instance. So in that respect, you're right. That's always been the problem. On the other hand, the news now is much more homogenized, and you would have expected the book publishers at least to step in where the press had failed. And what's interesting is that a few days after 9/11, a small New York publisher called Seven Stories issued a little book by Chomsky. It was really an extended interview with him about what was going on, and they immediately sold 300,000 copies of that little book. So it showed that there was a huge public interested in knowing what was going on, and yet none of the big publishing groups, none of the major houses published anything critical of American policy for those crucial first 2 years. They went along with the newspapers. They went along with the TV stations. So the small independent publishers were doing their job, and the New Press, among others, were certainly in there fighting, but they did not, of course, have the resources to reach the broader public that the larger houses have. So you had a relatively homogenized and coherent picture there, which is part of the problem.
Talk about how this is impacting the debate about ideas in general, beyond investigative journalism. simply the whole arena of new ways of looking at politics, at culture, of ideas, how that's being impacted by this consolidation we're talking about.
Right. Well, one of the problems which I talk about in this new book is that there is, in effect, a kind of commercial censorship at work in the way the large companies deal. A new book has to have an established audience of some thousands, tens of thousands, before it can get by the commercial people who are making the decisions as to whether or not they should publish the book. And, of course, a new idea, by definition, just does not have an established audience. You know, when I first published Chomsky's book about the Vietnam War, if our salespeople had said, what did his last book sell, which was a treatise on linguistics, it would have been in the hundreds. The book ended up selling tens and tens of thousands and had a huge impact on the way we thought about Vietnam. But now a book of that kind would not get through the machinery. That, in spite of the, you know, in addition to the fact that many of the large publishing houses, like those controlled by Murdoch, have a policy which is well to the right of center. But the system in itself is already established to limit the flow of new ideas, and that in itself is both extremely dangerous and also shows the importance of having the smaller independent publishers.
Talk about why it is dangerous. The price we're paying as a democracy and as a free society for limiting that discussion.
Right. Well, we see that price around us every day. I mean, one of the other examples, quite apart from the Iraqi war, is the economic crisis that we've just gone through that has cost the country trillions of dollars and millions of jobs. This is in part due to the fact that the newspapers and the publishers were not publishing any of the economists who were saying that we were living a lie, that this myth of a Friedman that was controlling the thought in most universities and certainly in the government, that the market can do no wrong, had established a kind of iron curtain around the truth. And you even get, you know, the head of the Fed saying, oh, well, it never thought possible that the markets might not be infallible. So the fact, which is clear and which has been made very clear since by Paul Krugman and by Joseph Stiglitz and Galbraith and many others, these arguments were not available. And for the most part, the newspapers covering the business beat were not asking the questions that they should have been asking. So between Iraq and the global economic meltdown, you've got, you know, enough of a proof of how important it is to have a debate that you know, than anything else I could think of.
To what extent has the Internet, and specifically blogs and people out there putting out new ideas, to what extent has that been helpful? Because unlike investigative journalism, it is an area that has a lower barrier to entry.
It does have a lower barrier, but it also has a lower access because, there are millions of blogs, there are millions of sources, and people simply don't know to whom to turn. A few have broken through, like Politico and some of the other better websites, but they are the exception. People assume that if they have a blog, they'll reach an audience, and of course that isn't the case. There's also the case, as the head of Google has said, that the web is a cesspool of misinformation. That's a quote. And an enormous number of lies circulate on it. And indeed, if you look at the number of lies that are believed in America today, the fact that the idea that Obama is a Muslim or that he was born overseas and so on, or that there were death panels in his plan for health insurance, these were circulated on the web with no chance for refutation or real discussion and debate. So while I have nothing against the actual technology, I think in time the web can be an extremely important and has been an important instrument. It is also open to all of these distortions and all of these lies, when we can call them nothing else but that. People are deliberately using it to spread misinformation.
To what extent, in your view, is this a global problem that we're facing, or is it more specific to the U.S. right now?
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't know enough about what the blogs are like in the Arab world or in Europe to be able to answer that. I think the U.S. is certainly at the spearhead of confusion and disinformation. On the other hand, you have the other situation where the Chinese government hires hundreds, if not thousands, of people to censor the internet or to openly disagree with stories that are placed on the internet, acting as if they were independent citizens rather than government employees. So you have a situation which shows that the internet is seen as potentially useful and is curtailed in as many places as possible.
To the extent that the economic models that we talked about earlier seem to be pretty much in place, what ways do you see in which some of these issues that we've been discussing can be mediated?
Well, of course, it's a question of what do you mean by in place. There are a lot of other countries, and this is the point of the words and money, is to show what's going on in Europe and elsewhere, where this is not the situation at all. Most European countries have given substantial subsidies to the press. All of them have a public network of radio and TV, which is paid for entirely by taxes on television sets and the like. There are countries like Norway that make a policy of helping any newspaper that has political opinion and is a not-for-profit, so that nearly all of the press gets substantial help from public sources without any political control whatsoever. So there are other models available. We just don't even know about them in the U.S. because the press, among other things, did not write about the press in any interesting and helpful fashion. So the purpose of Words and Money is to try to correct that to some degree by giving a lot of very concrete examples of what other people have done and how well those examples have worked.
But even to the extent that we were far more aware of what some of those models were, do you see anything in our debate about this, in our politics or anything else, that would lead us to be more receptive to adopting some of those models?
Well, of course, that's a difficult question to answer. But I think the only thing we can do is say we at least need to discuss the alternatives. We need to use the existing media to say, look, there are better ways to do this. And there is some hope in what happened in Congress the other year when, as you may remember, the Bush people were trying to change the anti-monopoly laws that forbade a company from having a newspaper and a TV station in the same city. That's been one of the basic forces to maintain some diversity in American media, and partly as a payoff for the presses having played along with the Bush government. They were trying to sneak through the FCC a change of these regulations. Well, some groups like Free Press, Bob McChesney's group, and others got hold of this and started writing about it, and in fact, the NRA and other groups on the other side of the spectrum picked up the issue. And within a few months, 3 million letters had been sent to the Congress against the change, and the plan was dropped. So it shows that if people are aware of the problem, if there is some discussion of the dangers, they will react, that it is a politically viable issue. It's one that can mobilize people on all sides of the spectrum, right as well as left. But you have to have the discussion and have people pointing to the difficulties. Now, you know, the question of how to help the press in the future is only beginning to be discussed. Bob McChesney has written a book, and my book, I think, are the first blasts at trying to raise a debate on these issues. But hopefully, I think people will begin to realize, as more and more newspapers fold, that this is a crucial problem.
What about the phenomenon of people being more focused on only what it is that interests them, the idea of the long tail? And what impact is that having on a broader sense of ideas and journalism?
Well, there is, of course, the real danger that people will personalize on the web, as you can do easily, the newspaper or the other information sources, so that you only get the kind of information that you wanted. And to some degree, the papers themselves have encouraged this by having these separate sections devoted to fashion or food or whatever. The New York Times has for years said, you know, read us the way you want, which seems to suggest that people, particularly women, can skip the news pages and just stick to the goodies on the food page. So they have, you know, helped to build up this kind of an approach. But you still have the whole package in your hands. You could still at least look at the headlines. The Internet can make that much more difficult. It can have you sent each day the news about, you know, your hometown or just the latest recipes or whatever it is that you're looking for in the newspaper, and forget about Iraq, forget about WikiLeaks, forget about Afghanistan, forget about everything else.
Talk about the economic models for news on the web and this ongoing debate with respect to the expectations now that newspapers and news and information is free versus pay models that many are talking about.
Right. Well, of course, the idea that something is free because it has advertising is one the advertising people have been pushing for years, but of course it's not true at all. Advertising, in effect, is a private tax. Every time you buy a product that's been advertised, you're paying for the ads. And, the advertising people will say, well, you know, we've made things into cheaper mass market items, but the only really cheap items you can find in the supermarket are those that have a house brand and precisely have not been advertised. So part of what we need to do is realize that we are already paying for the news, but we're not necessarily getting what we want to do. What we want, and you know, the solution may be for Murdoch successfully to sell the Wall Street Journal on the web because people want the business news and are ready to pay for it. For the most part, the attempts to do this have not been successful.
And do you see any reason to think that if they are successful, that it will provide some kind of economic base for journalists to do the things that they need to do?
Well, you know, so far the reason that the Times and the others have not done this is because the income that they would have gotten from pay-as-you-read would have not been sufficient to pay for their costs. It would not have replaced the advertising budget that they would have had. It just doesn't pay to send enough reporters to Afghanistan. So this is the real problem. The way things have changed for newspapers, the degree to which ads have been drained from the press means that they're just not going to have the money to do the essential jobs that we need in a democracy unless they get some kind of outside help. Now, everybody will say, oh, well, government help, government control, that's the last thing you want. But, you know, you only have to look at the BBC or the CBC or all of the television and radio in Europe and see that there have been models for years in which by having a tax on the TV set, you are giving an independent trust fund the money that they can then feed to the newspapers. And it's interesting to see that when PBS was first thought of, the initial report suggested precisely such a tax on television sets to finance PBS, which, of course, is now in great difficulty, and the Republicans are trying, as usual, to cut back on the budget of NPR and the others. So there are ways to do this. There are ways that have worked that keep the media free of governmental control and give you a real alternative.
Talk a little bit about coming back to the publishing industry and the impact that technology and particularly the proliferation, which now seems to really have hit critical mass of e-books, is going to have on publishing, do you think?
Well, you know, it's not yet a critical mass. It's 9% at most so far of people who have bought an e-book. And those books have practically always been bestsellers. So that the idea that, you know, everybody will soon be reading everything on the e-book format is premature. What is happening, and which is really dangerous, is that Amazon and Google have been trying to establish a monopoly on distribution. And earlier in the year, there was this battle between Amazon and the American publishers in which Amazon wanted to take all the profit from publishing and give the firms a small percentage of the take because they had a monopoly. And when the Macmillan Group protested and said they wouldn't go along, they said, okay, we'll just not list your books on Amazon anymore. Now, if ever there was a violation of antitrust law, I think that would have been it. And yet nobody in the government called up and said, wait a minute, what are you guys doing? You're abusing your position. So that is the real danger, and that's something that we need to talk about. And in Europe, there are government decisions all over the place saying that this is not going to be allowed, and alternatives that are being created. In France, the independent bookstores, for instance, have gotten together 1,000 stores to do an alternative website to Amazon, something they should have done a long time ago, but which is a real answer.
Of course, one of the problems in all of this is that with respect to bookstores. In Europe, you have a lot more independent bookstores than you have here, because the consolidation in the distribution side took place at the same time as the consolidation in the publishing side.
Right, indeed. And part of the problem there, and I discuss it at length in the book, is that the consolidation took place with no control of the prices, so that Barnes & Noble and the others could give heavy discounts on their books until the independent bookstores were driven out, and then, of course, bring the prices back up once they had a much stronger bargaining position. In New York City, where I used to work in a bookstore as a kid, we had 333 bookstores in the city in the 50s. We now have under 30, including the Barnes & Nobles. So they have managed to greatly harm the proliferation of independent bookstores. And you look at Europe, the comparison, you know, Germany has something like 8 times as many bookstores as does the United States with a fraction of its population.
Are there political voices that you hear at all that are addressing or willing to address some of these issues?
There are in Europe. There aren't here, unfortunately. And part of the problem is that this economic situation is so dire that this looks like a luxury debate, something that is only secondary to the national interest. But it is something that people should be discussing, and there have been people in the FCC who've been very good, and hopefully one would have hoped that with the new Obama administration that the voices of those people would have been strengthened in Washington, but that's yet to be seen.
Andre Schifrin, the book is Words and Money. It's just out from Verso Press. Andre, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Not at all. A pleasure.
Thank you.